exactly like he is in the film. Very warm, sympathetic man. He's had a lot of experiences in life and was willing to do this for Georges. Most of the people said, well, I wouldn't do this for anybody else, but for Georges, I will go through this.
So did this mean that Georges, in the intervening, what is it, almost 4 years, kept in touch with his family, came down summertime, helped?
I wish he had, but he didn't do nearly enough of that, which was one of the reasons we have the real problem, diplomatic problems.
He had thought, what was it, 78 going? Was 70
from about 48 to
78. He'd been, last time he was there in the early 50s, and then in the 70s he'd been down there.
So
there had been some people had come to see him in Paris, but he had not been there very much at all. He kept in contact with Henri mostly by Christmas cards, for instance.
So that despite the fact that he had essentially left, moved away physically,
they were still willing, because of the force of his personality and the warmth they felt for him, and many other reasons. But
these characters weren't paid at all.
Yes. Oh, yes. They were paid. That's one thing that was a premise of making the new film. Couldn't have been made any other way, anyway. But it's one of the one thing that we insisted on, that we at the from the American end of things, particularly insisted on. And Georges saw that also as a necessity, that every person who played a role in this film be paid an equitable wage. So they were paid on as the lowest scale of normal French actors, on a daily basis or on a half-day basis. It wouldn't have been possible to do it any other way. Certain characters like Henri probably would have been willing to be in the film anyway, not for financial gain, just because they wanted to do this. Georges had an enormous reputation in certain people's minds in this village. The making of Farabik was a very high point in their life as a family and individual lives. So the idea of making another one wasn't a negative one for many people. For certain people, however, certain people felt because especially at Farabik, they had not been paid adequately in 1944-45. They were paid very little, almost nothing. The house, electricity was brought to the house. The house was wired. They got a little money, and that was it. That was 44-45. Conditions had changed. And some people in the family, again, that's why I mean it's family politics. Some people in the family felt that Georges, because the film Farabik actually was a success in France, a financial as well as a commercial, critical success, that he had made a mint off of their backs, off of their labor. They didn't understand Georges' role as an artist first in putting this together. That he didn't just sort of take pictures of people and put them together in any which way and then have a film which was commercially successful or artistically successful. So they didn't understand what an artist does. And second, they also didn't understand that Georges did not own the film. Georges was not the producer of the film. Georges did not make a bundle off of it. The producers may have made a bundle off of it. And the producers should have perhaps come back to Boutrance and said, listen, we'd like to give you some money or build a building in town or something or other as a way of thanking you in a material way. They didn't do that, and that's something we had to struggle with. But nonetheless, Henri and Georges always got along very well. Henri and his brother Ruck were somewhat more distant, and Henri and Berthe, the wife of Ruck, were extremely distant. So I think for Henri, this is again family politics. For Henri, the idea of making another film with Georges was a way of finding revenge against his sister-in-law, and against to some degree against his own brother Buck at Farabik. Well, he's the one who has to leave the farm and go find work elsewhere. But the one who has, according to the portrait made in 1944-45 in the film, about being the one who has the most creative imagination, and the one who perhaps might have made more of Farabi than William Armitage. Nonetheless, by the time the film was made, you'll all be happy to know that at the end of it, everybody was reconciled with everybody. We had an incredible dinner, and people were singing songs, and for a brief moment anyway, all the DJs seemed to like each other. So. Now, outside of Goutrens, we're now at Farbeek. As I say, this is taken from the road between Goutrens and Rignac, and you look across the meadow towards the farm. Here you see the older buildings, which you saw in the film, and to the left the new house, which is sort of a shock in the film. The sign that points to Farbeek and the road down there is, that's the way it really is. There is not now, nor was there ever, a sign that said Farbeek and Beekvaar in the same one that was made for the purposes of the film. Beekvaar disappeared as a farm 10 years ago and was absorbed by Farbeek, but not in the way that the film portrays it. All that's left at Beekvaar itself is a part of the barn, one wall. And Remo uses it to keep a tractor. The house that we used for Beekvaar, it was a couple of miles away.
That beautiful slide that you made.
Yeah, I think this is one of yours.
No.
No?
Well, maybe it is.
Could be.
Not too bad. That shot of
the this was our first time at Farbeek, and Remo, the younger son, the 4445, has come to take us around to show us the old buildings. Lawrence Wiley in the middle and George McKinney there. And the stairway in the old house, which is used for hanging sausages, for keeping things which don't fit in the house.
And Maurice.
And for, yes, cousin, you remember the baby who was born in Farbeek, Maurice, who's now 38, he lives in the outskirts of Paris, and he and his wife and their son come to Farbeek sometimes for a week or two in the summer, and they'll stay here in this house. It serves as a guest house. Also, Ruck, often in the summer when it's warm, will come over and sleep in the old house because it feels more comfortable. This is the back of the old house. The one of the cracks in the wall, which the grandfather's constantly looking at, was over in here. In fact, in the film, that's the one that they filmed. So you can't tell exactly where it is. See, I think it was your stuff.
Well, that was mine.
That definitely is. Donna Evlith was a person we used, the woman on the left here, person we used as a research assistant. She came down with John Weiss to do research at Farbeek. She was with Rainbow. It's one of our few pictures I have of Rainbow. And Ruck. Ruck normally smiles a lot, but became very serious for his portrait. He felt that it was a serious moment, so he lost his smile. Now, to tell you something about the effect of making a film like Farbeek on a man like Ruck in this context. When I first met Ruck this day, shortly before I took this picture, after we said hello and exchanged names, you must understand also that he speaks a dialect which is very difficult to understand. Not used to talking about it, for he's missing a few teeth, and he also speaks a difficult dialect. It's hard to understand, so sometimes I had trouble understanding. But I did understand this point, which was that practically after we were introduced, he said, "Monsieur, you know, I don't really look up ladies' skirts." this, in the film Farbeek, he's pictured as looking up, at the end of the spring sequence, he's looking up his wife's skirts and bodice. I think it's perfectly innocent image in the film. was made in two pieces. And George filmed, first he has Mark one day to look up, takes a picture. Several days later, a woman is standing at the top of a ladder looking for eggs in the straw, and took a picture from a lower angle. And then in the editing room, he put the two together, so it looks like Buck is looking up. And of course, Gluck never saw that connection until the film was projected at the Paris Opera in its premiere. I expect he was a little taken back. But the way that it worked is that other people around the town never let him forget that this had happened. And also, they saw that it bothered Gluck. If he had laughed it off, or had said, yes, all the time, that's what I spend my life doing, nobody would have bothered him. But as it was, he became a victim of that shot. And to the extent that this American guy shows up and he blurts out immediately that I quote it, you understand that I really am a moral character, and I don't spend my life doing it. What are you saying to him?
They never saw the film.
They did not see the film before it was... This time they did not see the completed film until it was ready and until it was shown in the marketplace.
Somebody said that.
No, we couldn't change anything. Well, I suppose we could have changed something. We really had to. This time, the great difference was that in this case, everybody all the main characters read the screenplay entirely, understood what the storyline was going to be. There were no surprises like this one. The surprises came for people whose parts were cut out of them, with small parts, to some economy, not financial economy, but to make the film 90 minutes longer, to keep it moving, their entire role disappeared. Those people were upset. Fine. Not what they had done, but what they weren't doing. So
he doesn't actually have a stroke.
Yes.
No. In real life, he did not have a stroke. He had been ill. He had been very ill. That's one of the main reason why we were not able to film very much at Fargo, because he had been extremely ill. He recovered, and we were able to film. However, since the making of the film, last fall, he did have a stroke and was paralyzed on the other side of the film. He's now getting around on canes and walks around the houses.
He managed to look extraordinarily like a stroke victim.
Yes, that's what's really stupendous. He gave an incredible performance. Getting out of the car and walking to the cemetery when his foot drops to the ground. He would be at least 70. Wonderful. A voice, he can sing, magnificent, and that's one of the things that he's a member of the Senior Citizens Club, and when they do something, they always involve singing after dinner, and he has just a tremendous voice, and loves to sing. And one day we were there, and he started singing a song which comes from the 1830s, which he said that his grandfather had. He probably had this song since he was a child. He was singing about the assassination of the Duke. So. Whoops. This bodes ill for the rest of the slide. Now, here we are at the farm, which we were using as a set for Big Far. Raoul, whose real name is Roger Mallet, and who is also a grandson of Farbeek. His mother is one of the, is Henri's sister and Huck's sister, Georges' first cousin. And his mother and father are, you see them in the film Farbeek. We don't make any of that connection, but he is actually the family. He's walking across here and going to bring hay to his sheep, supposedly behind this door, or actually this door. If you actually look through there, you would simply see a vacant area. Beyond this wall, this farm is completely falling apart. And here the house is up to our left, And if you look to further back to the left, you'd see a roof which was caving in. So this is a house which, a farm which had been abandoned. The house is being maybe restored, we'll see. But it was abandoned in the period in the late 40s and has remained the same since that time. So for the purpose of the film, he walks across here, and our next shot shows him actually at his own farm, at home, feeding his own sheep. So we want to cheat that way to filmically to give you the idea that it's going on. Oh, bad news. Give you a feeling for how these kinds of images are achieved, how these people work. Here we have Marius Benaben reading his lines. He was probably the laziest of the actors in terms of knowing what he was supposed to say. Constantly had a script handy. We did not film great long scenes with him at one time, but it was always had to be worried about whether he had read the stuff or not. Oh yeah. No. They memorize him.
Can you tell how we got the shot of him looking mesmerized by the TV?
What was he actually watching? I don't know.
Playboy centerfold. Put that on the TV. That's what he was watching instead. He looked mesmerized. According to George.
His wife, Hélène, who plays Hortense. She and Maria Rouquet are really sisters. So those family relationships are genuine. And this farm, which is called Bourrel and Farbique, actually do adjoin. And they would have wanted the same land. And they are rivals between Farbique and Bourrel. All that helps build the emotion of these.
Yeah. Those final scenes of confrontation. There's a lot.
Right.
Out there, yeah.
Now we're rehearsing here a noontime scene at this place. Everybody is just practicing emotions. And now they're doing it more seriously. Actually, it's filmed from a slightly different angle, but now this is a little overexposed, but I left it in here to show you the outside of a farm building where we did some shooting, and you'll notice that great care has been taken with the landscaping. This is the work of Colette Brasse. She's a wonderful woman who has taken extreme care to make everything gorgeous. However, the one thing that's lacking here is the odor, which comes from inside the barn, this is where the veal calves are being kept in the stalls or boxes. We went through a whole thing here, understanding how the veal calves are fed with this powdered milk, this medicated stuff. You'll notice here that we had to rip off the label because the manufacturers were not pleased that we were showing these things. Rip off the label at any point where it was going to be obvious exactly what it was. But the words which appear in the film and which are mistranslated in the subtitle says aliments médicamenteux pour vous, medicated food for veal. George's idea here was that it was important that people see the kind of artificial food which is being given to these veal calves, which is then sold at such a high price in the marketplace, which has no, in George's point of view, little or no nutritive value, and a sort of industrial production. And then the measuring out, again, Rouquier tries to see all of the details of how a particular action is accomplished, why it is, and then he analyzes that, and then he reconstructs it for the
without making certain points. It's a somewhat didactic style here, mixed with the drama, with the fiction. Because he has certain things he wanted to make sure that people understood. And in fact, he's only partially successful because, for him, the images, the juxtaposed images of the veal calves in these awful boxes where they cannot move, next to the calves which are being brought up by more traditional methods in the Aveyron, where the mother cow is licking the back of the calf. It's a beautiful image, and of course we did not coach the cow. It's just devastating for Georges, and yet people in general do not get the point. They do not, if we had, we should have, this is where we should have odor vision.
Film made up, I don't.
Yeah, except it's a little unfair, because, I mean.
Nothing's fair in this
film. No, I mean, I thought that, you know, the first one was so romantic and so idealistic, and it's, you know, you could have shown them treating animals in a very barbaric way in the old film, too. You know, and, mm-hmm. and veal calves is always barbaric. You know, they've always taken them away from others.
Well, you see, in this part of the Aveyron, they actually don't. There is a method called the Les Beaux sous la mer, where the calves are not taken away from the mothers, but allowed to suckle until they're incredibly large animals. And then they have, one of the interesting things they've done in this region is they have established a co-op where people from all over France can buy meat raised in these natural methods, no artificial food, directly from the farm itself and then sent to them frozen, or through certain butchers in Paris which are organized for this kind of it's not a fair film. It has a point of view, and Georges, who is very concerned about what's going on with agricultural methods, yes, he could have shown less pretty sides of life in 1944-45. But he chose not to. Here, he really felt that he had to make a few points.
More.
Oh, he could have been much more brutal.
No, but he could have shown more of the care and the gentle side and the relationship between animals. I mean, he made a point mm-hmm. not showing anything. And
well,
I thought that was unfair, too. I mean, maybe that's all he saw.
Well, methods of industrial production do not call for much.
Well,
interchange between
and this is
the people.
Industrial production compared to what, you know, Arabs do in Utica, and where they have 800 cows.
Oh yeah. Oh, I know. This is on French scale.
Time,
yeah.
Right.
This is small time. Within the barn, it looks like this. And here we are setting up for doing it. But the smell from these animals is just really disgusting.
And they clean the stalls.
They clean the stalls, but. Because of what they're fed, they have this sort of constant diarrhea, and it's just really revolting. And they're basically put in there, and when they reach the height, the size where they can no longer stand or lie down in these caves, then their cages are sent off to the butcher. We are actually doing. Away from farming problems for a minute. one of the ways that we inserted images from the past in the present was to use these pictures from the film Farbique on the wall of Henri's house. And here Georges is showing the actor how he wants him to look at a few of these images before he does it. This is our assistant cameraman who comes from a somewhat different world. A dinner scene, which looks so easy in the film, and is so complicated in reality. Point I wanted to make there. I like this one because of Roger there in the background who's seeing that I'm taking a picture and looking at me.
speed.
Hey, come on.
One of the great differences in generations in the film is between Henri's son, Pierre, and Henri. Can't imagine that they belong in the same family, but they do. And here he was waiting for his scene. And in the scene itself.
How's he doing, Bill? Have you found out?
I don't know. He's still in medical school, apparently. I haven't heard this year. The apparatus of cinema continues. Filmmaking is also a time of celebration at the same time. There are all kinds of people. You have a good time at certain points making a film. And this is just sort of part of the crew sitting outside one of these farm buildings and relaxing for a moment. This kind of experience for the crew is very important.
How many of those crew had worked together?
A number of them had worked together before. Couldn't tell you the exact number.
Any of them worked on the earlier film?
No.
Wasn't there one he tried to get and had? I forget. I guess not.
I don't think so. They're all trying to get the scene where the insecticide falls on the pesticide falls on the
van.
Yeah. Of course, we didn't really use.
No.
We had to find something that would
use powdered fall. Milk, right?
I think it may have been a mixture of plaster and powdered milk. Something that would look like it was similar material and look and would fall right. It was very complicated from the right stuff. So just a shot in the bedroom of Henri and Maria one day. Various effects were just stuck there, including the tombstone that we used in the film. The tombstone was remade for a couple of reasons. One of the things that we did wrong in the film was a mistake made, is that it says Jacques Rouquier, who is the grandfather in the early film, the 44-45 film, who died in 1951, which is represented on his tombstone. But in the film, in the world of cinema, he died in 1945 or 47, and that was something which escaped Rouquier as he was working between
reality.
How much reality was in this and how much fiction was this. Even he got confused as to that detail. Again, the ambiance on the set was very pleasant. We had on that take. Let's work through those others. The kitchen has been completely transformed now. It's a very difficult place to film it. Because of the acoustics, you can hear it in the soundtrack.
It's Henri's kitchen.
But also, people from the crew and people from the town got together at things like this, which we had a wonderful meal together, one of many. And people were at work getting us set up. And that's what we had. Mishui. That's the director of photography and me. I was making a collection of junk cars in the rural French countryside. And
what?
A contribution.
What is that, an old Packard?
No, it's not a Packard. I think it's an old Simca. It was just sitting out in one of these farms in the... So I have a small collection of junk car photographs. We decided was better than pictures of rural churches. So that's
right. That's, you've seen one of those, boy.
Okay. Oh, when Rouquier was here visiting, he would get into fights with some of the people in the ag school over the whole issue of productivity. You know, the guys in the ag school would say, you know, you got to use hormones, you got to use artificial food, or you're not going to be able to feed the world. Everybody's going to starve. But Rouquier was saying, there's got to be a better way, and these hormones, we can pull him off people when he was visiting over there. Sometimes for the fights. And I think these Ferme 85 works sort of do show that some of the alternatives that can be developed, and I don't know how far it can go, but the real question, these guys are serious. And
Yeah. Oh, you talk. You sit down and wander into their kitchen and, you know, and ask them about this question. You know, you've got 2 hours of conversation.
They're
not, you're not coming from.
It, right?
Oh, they wouldn't. Oh, from.
Them even around here. See, your farms will not even do. They grow their own.
They grow their own.
Well, I didn't know that part of the potato farms, but I know they're not. And the Aveyron itself is polluted now, I think, in that section of the river.
The rivers
just can't be used.
I mean, in this country, the climate, at least pollution, is taking a turn. You know, it's better.
Yeah,
you go to Madrid
up.
And you go to New York, you know, better than Madrid.
Yeah, the Mediterranean,
you know,
is a dead pond.
Oh, Mediterranean. I was there last time. I was just crying. I just this feeling of just dying.
Yeah.
I mean, we were in Montpellier, and then we went down to the Spanish coast, and it was just awful.
Yeah.
And you can't eat fish, you can't swim. And all these American refineries, you know, that are set. Beautiful. It just smells like South Jersey.
Yeah.
We don't let them do that here anymore, so they go over there and do it.
No,
and you go to the fish, and you go to a fish restaurant, and things that taste like oil.
I don't know.
We go to Maine a lot. There, of course, there's just so fatalistic about it. Well, there's nothing we can do about it. That's just what they're terrible. Just, I mean, I just think from France, mm-hmm. quite that.
No, they're not quite, but almost.
Yeah,
I guess it has to get a little worse.